Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Moira Gunn, host of NPR's Tech Nation, and I will be moderating tonight's program. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Jamie Heineman and Adam Savage, hosts of the extremely popular television series on the truth about science, called the Mythbusters. Please welcome the Mythbusters. Well, Jamie and Adam, I have to say, you know, the truth about science. You guys don't see yourself as scientists, do you?
Oh, no.
No. No, it's a funny thing. We're very curious about what we're facing on these things. We're so curious about it that it's like a dog after a scent. We can't wait to go. And it turns out that to do that you want to be efficient and methodical about it. That's the best way to get the answers that you need, and that happens to be science, I suppose.
Jamie's got a degree in Russian studies, and I have a high school diploma.
Yeah.
And I think a couple of pottery classes.
Yeah. Well, don't forget, we had that great series of modules on NPR for a while called Ask Dr. Science. And at the opening, he says, I have a master's degree in science. So
I always liked that.
Yes. And his byline was always, I know more than you do. So.
Well, actually, you've touched upon something which I think is a central part of why we enjoy doing the show and why we actually really like talking to fans about what they like about the show is we definitely don't know more than you do. I mean, I ask audiences all the time how many of you have yelled at me and Jamie at the television and called us idiots, and half the hands always go up. I mean, the narrative of each show is about us trying to figure out what we want to learn about what we're doing and overlapping our various ignorances and trying to come to some agreement through a process we call arguing and come to at least some kind of truth about the thing.
Yeah, at this point, I actually think we've learned so much from the show itself. I mean, we certainly didn't start out with. We were effects artists. That's what we've been doing for a long time, and so we were familiar with a wide range of materials and processes, and pretty creative at handling them. But now, after 7 years of doing this, the insights we've gained have actually been quite extraordinary as a result of the show. It's sort of this. Broad, this weird broad foundation that we have that's come to us as a result of taking these processes and materials to their breaking point or to some sort of extreme, which is not normally what you do when you're studying, you know, things in college or something. But
in engineering, we like to build things, not generally blow them up.
Yeah, well,
we're always trying to meter some situation, like when the CO2 would kill you or, you know, something like that. And the meters, every meter has a red zone in it, and the red zone tells you when to leave. But that's not what we want to know. We want to know when you die. And the meters never go that far. So we're always having to come up with new ways to meter things because the people from the meter companies go, no, we don't go that far.
Yeah, so it's been an unusual education in that sense, and it's been very revealing. We've seen stuff that nobody else has seen from stretching these things like this. It's been really, really odd, and I think we've learned so much that we've got some kind of education out of the process. I'm not sure what it is, but it's definitely there. We're doing a lot more things now than we would have been able to do when we started.
Now, while it is true that you've come out of special effects, you in a sense must have been in special effects, by how you were, what you did. I mean, a lot of people say, wouldn't it be great if somebody came along and asked me to do this series called The Mythbusters? But in fact, you were doing all kinds of crazy things before. I actually ran into you guys a number of years ago, before The Mythbusters, at Robot Wars.
Yes.
Now, I was the head judge for a couple of years there. And actually, describe what Robot Wars was about.
The Robot Wars started in San Francisco in 1992 or 93.
Something like that.
And I was working in my first job in special effects back then for my boss, Jamie Heineman. And we heard about this thing called Robot Wars, and Jamie came back and said, I think we could build this. Well, he said, I think I can build this robot. And his idea was actually to take this robot that was basically a flywheel with no engine in it and no motor, and you'd spin the flywheel up to like 20,000 RPM. And the robot only had to run for 5 minutes for the match. So you'd just figure out however fast you'd have to get it going so that it would spin for 5 minutes and power everything else off that spinning, and figured the centrifugal force was the greatest conservator of energy and it would be the most devastating delivery system.
And at the edge of the flywheel, as it's spinning around, what was there?
Well, you're moving ahead, because the interesting thing that I found out when I started along this line of thought was that, and this was way before Blendo itself was actually built.
Blendo is the favored robot.
Yeah. The thing I found out was, doing the math on it, ended up with a 4-foot disc spinning at 20,000 RPM. The perimeter of that would be going something like Mach 4.
And a little fast.
At the time, I didn't really know what that meant, but it sounded like it was awful fast, and I didn't think I could quite get there. So I talked to a physicist friend of mine, and he said, actually, well, you know, first off, the steel wouldn't be strong enough because the centrifugal force would just tear the thing apart. But if you did get it going that fast, it would probably go off like a flashbulb because of the friction and heat. So, you know, I started working my way back from there, and I realized that actually, you know, it's amazing what the kind of energy that you get, because even just a few hundred RPM with a fairly significant weight.
Yeah, the first time we turned it on, it sliced right through the wall of sandbags that was protecting us from it.
And I reckoned as well that, you know, with all this weight out there, it'd be kind of hard to control it. And so maybe it shouldn't be going that fast if I was still able to deliver a devastating blow. And Blendo, as it was, had about 150 pounds of mass that was spinning. The rest of the weight of the thing was in the car and radios and drive systems in the center of it.
But to show people, it was maybe about a foot tall with sort of a black dome.
It was like a flying saucer.
Yeah. It was like a flying saucer.
That was a Chinese wok that I'd gotten from the local restaurant supply.
One of my questions on this piece of paper here.
And actually, I want to point out that the main rings of Blendo were, we didn't have a lathe big enough to machine them to a fine surface. So Jamie took a Lazy Susan and put a drill motor on it and set it in this empty room for 3.5 days with an angle grinder just sitting on it. It was the worst sound in the world coming from this room.
Every time something out of round would come past the angle grinder, there'd be this shower of sparks. And, you know, and I'd check on it every hour and kick it a little closer to the wheel. And it actually did a darn good job of centering that thing. But at any rate, that ring and the wok that was bolted to it amounted to the flywheel. It was the exterior of the robot. Its armor was actually spinning, which made it harder to penetrate, as well as provided this energy storage for the engine that wound it up. That 150 pounds rotating it around 500 RPM was equivalent, if you do the math on it, to a chunk of steel about the size of my fist going the speed of sound when it hit. That was the amount.
Do not try this at home, young people in the audience.
And that was only at 500 RPM. You know, we don't need 20,000. And probably, I rightly suspected that there were all sorts of problems if we had gotten it going that fast. But, in fact, we'd probably
suspect?
It would have destroyed the entire arena at some point people.
These were all robots that, you know, you remotely controlled. What were the controls? What could you control with this thing spinning like mad on the floor?
Well, actually, I did the control system for it, and what we had was at the top of the wok, we put in a vacuform clear Lexan polycarbonate top so that you could see the central drive system, and we put lights in there so that even though the outside was spinning, you always had a red and a green light, and you knew which direction it was pointed in, theoretically.
Because there were wheels on the bottom.
Yes. Yeah. The problem was that, well, it was quite hard to control because it tended to want to steer in one direction, which was the opposite direction it happened to be spinning in. But luckily, none of our matches. We had 4 matches in 2 years, and none of them lasted, I'm not exaggerating at all, none of them lasted more than 5 seconds. Opponent entered frame, Blendo entered frame, opponent touched Blendo, opponent was dead, and pieces of opponent were landing in the laps of insurance adjusters in the audience.
The length of the matches were exactly the lifetime of the opposing robot. Ever. So it was very exciting. It was very exciting.
Well, you know that it was on Robot Wars that a fledgling show produced out of Australia called Beyond 2000 came and did interviews with several of the major robot builders, and that traveling producer for Beyond 2000 interviewed Jamie as part of that Robot Wars, and he eventually came up with the idea for MythBusters and called us 10 years later to come and send a demo reel.
Now, Robot Wars was down here, for those of you who know San Francisco, down at Fort Mason, one of those big exhibit areas. And they had, what would you say, 8-foot plexiglass, rounds. And then they had, big bleachers. And, I mean, it was just wild with all this noise and everything was really pretty crazy. And it was so exciting. Oh, yeah, and these, one at a time they'd get in there and match off. And then they'd have a melee. It was really – and both those years – something great happened and something terrible happened. The terrible happened, you guys got disqualified.
Well, we didn't actually get disqualified, and I bristle when that's brought up because we
passed all the safety requirements.
Yeah, there was no.
You didn't bring a lawyer. That was the problem. Yeah,
we had gotten this device approved by the operator of the event at the time, and everything was just fine. In fact, we were given prize money and trophies, which generally they don't do to people that get disqualified. So,
Years in a row, we were awarded first prize in lieu of competition because they
bought us out.
They bought us off. That is not true. I was to give both years as the head judge. I was to award 2 prizes, one for best design and one for best robot or whatever it was. I'll have to go back and look at my notes. I probably have them. And so I wrote it. I awarded one to one guy, and I wrote it at the top of the competition to you. And they went you can't do that because we had to take them out of the. I said, doesn't say so on my sheet. No, you guys definitely had the best robot. Now, absolutely not. We were not bought off. You had the best robot.
Well, thank you.
That was great. Now, I have to tell you, my son's had some really great learning lessons because in one of those early trial runs with this plexiglass, it's the kind of plexiglass you put on all robotic systems around. It's that's what you got to do in the United States, at least. Not in Japan. In Japan, they put a yellow line down. They say, do not walk across. But in the United States, we got the plexiglass. So that's a good thing. And I was my sons were pretty young at the time, and I'd say, I'd take them with me there, and I'd say, now look. Always keep your eye and the robot, piece of plexiglass between you and the robots. And we'd be up in the judges thing, and I'd get them up there. Then they'd climb higher and higher because they'd really want to look down and see everything. And so finally, something came off one of your runs. And I've never seen this before. It made this huge dent and scar in the plexiglass. I have no idea.
It was actually about a 10-pound plate of steel that was... the faceplate, the armor of the opposing robot. So he had actually, in haste at the very last moment, attached it to because he knew that he was in trouble because
so we took it and beat him to death with it.
So he attaches this thing on and it became a projectile. There was a funny thing for us with this whole thing. We did this entering and getting pulled out two times in a row. There was a year in between, but both times that we fought in robot wars, the same thing happened. They raised the wall a little bit for the second time, and and nothing actually happened. That was when the gash appeared in the side of the arena. But it so terrified them. There was nothing that left the arena, but they just the judges, or there were some camera people or something that were right next to that thing when it hit, and they said it was like a gun going off.
No, I met somebody a couple of years ago at some event you and I were speaking at. And he said he was sitting right there.
Yeah.
He said it was the scariest thing that ever happened to him, this piece of, like, a playing card of death this big whistling across the arena and smacking right into the glass in front of him.
Well, I marched my sons right up, and I said, you see that? That's why I said keep the plexiglass between you and the robots.
Well, the thing that happened as a result of this getting pulled out of both of these events was that we acquired this aura of, like, you know, badness. That was just like you couldn't beat it. I mean, we were upset at the time. We were actually, you know, crestfallen because we'd worked so hard on this robot and we'd made such a splash. We were doing so well, and then we never really got to, you know, go straight through all the opponents. But this was the main thing that caught the attention of the producer that later had the idea for the show MythBusters. And it was also we were far more notorious as a result of getting kicked out than we would have been had we not had that problem.
Well, it is true, because as frightening as your robot was, your Demeter was even more frightening after you were thrown out.
Oh, yeah.
No, we were very specific about, like, we didn't talk to anybody. We were very sour-faced and just did our work. And
you weren't even very happy when I gave you the award.
Except when I found out, like, when another match was coming up and I'd find out who we were going against, I'd, like, you know, pull the file out and start sharpening Blendo's blades and kind of, you know, grinning at them. It actually worked. It actually freaked them out. It was amazing.
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of stories within stories there. But at any rate, but they approached you and said, we have this Australian company, we got this thing going here. And did they put out a proposal? Because you started on Discovery Channel, no?
Well, this was from this Australian production company that and Discovery has their go-to companies that actually produce their shows, and this was one that had done Beyond 2000 and some others, and so they had the idea that they pitched to Discovery, and they went out and tried to, once Discovery showed some interest, they went out and tried to get some. Their requirements was somebody that had a shop and somebody that would actually be able to replicate these circumstances that surround urban legends rather than just talk about them, because if you don't actually do anything, it can be kind of dry. And so they...
I just like to meet this guy. We should have him here saying, you met these guys and you said, you're my kind of guys.
Well, actually, we found out recently that the original concept for the show was a three-host show, where the main host was actually a hot chick who would travel around the country.
No kidding.
Travel around the country interviewing people about urban legends. And when she wanted to know if something was really true or not, she'd call back to her boys in a shop, and that would be, you know, presumably us. And Jamie got this call. We shot this demo reel. It was about, I don't know, we spent a couple of hours filming it. I cut it on my PowerBook into about 15 minutes of us introducing ourselves, setting something on fire, running from that thing. And then talking through a myth. And honestly, if you watch it today, at some point I'll make sure it gets up online. It's almost indistinguishable from the show. It looks like we shot it last week, except that I don't have any gray in my hair. Apparently they saw that and said, we don't need three hosts. We could do this whole thing with these two guys. And they showed up 3 weeks after we sent that demo reel in, and we've been filming ever since.
Now, where do you film?
We film right over in, is it India Basin?
It's at the base of Potrero Hill, and it's my shop my effects shop. We've produced somewhere in excess of 800 commercials, a couple dozen feature films, pretty much any major car brand or soda or anything else we've done commercials for, and And so we had all the equipment and the ability to launch right into this, and we did. And here we are. I pretty well dropped that business because it just was too much to shoot the show full time and keep what was by definition a problematic way of earning a living going. So we don't do that anymore. I still do some prototyping work in the background and things that I can't turn down, but it's all Mythbusters, and we're just having a ball.
We've now produced, I think, just a shade over a full week of programming, 24/7. I think we're filming our 171st hour of Mythbusters at this point, and we spent all day trying to break out of jail with antacid tablets, and we're having a great time.
Yeah, there's all sorts of stories that are coming up, and it's some of the best stuff that we've done has come out of recent years, or recent episodes even. And that amazes us because, you know, we often get asked, well, when are you going to run out of myths? But
well, I want to point out that actually after we shot the first three pilots of Mythbusters in the summer of 2002, we shot 9 myths in 6 weeks, a record we still have not yet matched. And afterwards, Jamie called me up and said, do you want to come get your crap out of the shop? And I went and got my crap out of the shop, and he said, that was fun. Don't really see where it could go, though. I think we did everything.
And I still pretty much feel that way every day I go to work. But somehow it really is amazing. I mean, we get something that interests us, and just all of a sudden there's this trail, this scent that we're on, and we're having a ball. I mean, the definition of urban legends maybe isn't quite so rigorously followed here. But ultimately, I don't think that the show. I mean, nobody's offered to give us an award for groundbreaking work on urban legends at this point.
But I'm glad you put it out on the radio and on the internet and all over television. This will do it. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of the California Radio. Sorry, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio program. We're talking with Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman from the hit television program, The Mythbusters. Well, there's a real question here. It said, "Truth and science. What's under the beret?"
My head?
That works for me.
He always complains that people keep talking about the hat, and yet he continues to wear it.
Is it the same hat over the years?
No, there's been a bunch of them.
There's a Monday hat and a Tuesday hat. And
they last quite a long time, though, and there's a funny thing about berets is that you may not know from watching the show, because it's never been highlighted for some reason, is that in hot weather you can get them wet and they cool your head.
Ooh. That's not a myth.
No. No. I do it all the time.
There you go. There you go. So French Foreign Legion learned that.
Yeah. And on the other hand, when it's cold, they keep your head warm.
I think you've got a future as sort of a poster child for the beret foundation.
Well, you know, when you don't have any hair, it's
more scientific truth.
Yeah, you've got to wear a hat sometimes.
Now, there's some themes here, so I'm going to combine some people's questions here. You're blowing up things all the time over these years. What have you learned about blowing things up now that you didn't know when you started?
Oh, can I take this one?
Let's go right ahead.
For us, it's kind of like a wine connoisseur. You know, it's like there's some explosions have kind of a oaky undertone with hints of raspberry or whatever in them.
It'll be like, oh, that's got a sharp snap at the front, but a real grunt on the back end. It's really fun.
Good legs.
Legs, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are, in fact, qualities known as, like, for example, brisants. There's these explosives have different speeds to them. They therefore interact with materials differently. Some slower things will be inclined to push things, like what they use in quarries and everything, where they want to bust up rock and move it. Other things like high explosives, high-speed explosives that are used in bombs will shred and tear and rip. And it's, you know, every time we use a different type of explosive or use them in a, you know, in some unusual environment, which at this point, I mean, we found we can bond metal, like we can bond copper to steel with explosives. You can actually do a lot of unusual things with them, and every time we get into one of these situations, it's a real eye opener. There's a lot. It's like this different world of things moving at high speeds that you have to think in different terms.
We've also learned a lot from the bomb squads that we've worked with. One of the things about bomb squads, it turns out, is that the military, when they're pegging people who might make good bomb technicians, has a set of criteria, psychological criteria, that read like me and Jamie, actually. So when we meet these guys, it's like long-lost brothers. We get along with every bomb squad we've ever met. We just love these guys, and they're obviously, they're working with very dangerous things, and they don't know often what's going to happen. So there's a lot of contingency planning, which is exactly what we're always doing. We're replicating circumstances under which someone got maimed or killed right there so the camera can look at it. But we're also there, and there's hidden dangers, things we don't know about. And the bomb technicians have taught us a lot of terrific methodologies, like, you know, put a building between you and the thing. You're not sure what'll happen. The building will likely absorb most of the problem.
They don't say sandbags.
No.
Okay. Yeah, you learned that lesson.
Yeah. Plus, there's a general attitude like, you know, any day that you don't die is a good day, and we sort of can, you know, we can relate to that.
When things are flying over your head, you screwed up.
That's good. Have you ever been arrested for blowing something up?
No. Nope. Generally, we have law enforcement with us when we're blowing
things up. Oh, you call the cops.
Right. Well, that's what's the difference between us and a pair of 14-year-old pyromaniacs. We actually call the cops first. There's nothing better than getting the fire department to help you set something on fire.
Yeah.
And they're really good at it.
Yeah, there's a lot of people asking, younger people, actually, in addition, I don't know how old some people, I'm sure people of all ages, including Randy 7 and Max 9, want to know how to get into this field.
One of us is going to have to die. Because we're not giving up the job.
Okay. All right.
However, I mean, actually, you know, the success of Mythbusters has led to programs like Mythbusters all over the world. There's Sports Science, there was Smash Labs, there was Prototype This, there's Bang Goes the Theory in England, there was Brainiac. All of these shows, I think, are built upon the basic Mythbusters model. And if you were looking for work along one of those things, I have no idea. You know, I joke that we're kind of journeyman polymaths. We want to be a dilettante at almost everything we can get our hands on. That really does actually also define a terrific special effects artisan, is someone who understands a little bit about absolutely everything. And neither of us are expert craftsmen at any skill that we have, but each little piece of knowledge is like an arrow to be applied towards a specific target.
But if one did want to have a practical version of this kind of work, it would be some form of engineering. Now, unfortunately,
a background which neither of us possesses.
Yeah. The thing.
But I do have to tell you, I am an engineer, and I went to Purdue, and you guys went to Purdue. All the engineers, and there are tens of thousands of them at Purdue, were thrilled. They think you're engineers. So
that was a great crowd.
There you go.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, I mean, a lot of engineers from the ones that I've talked to that are out and about end up spending their lives sitting in front of a computer, which is maybe not as exciting as the kind of things that we do on some level. But what's going on in their heads is a different story. And the fact is that if you ask Adam or I what is the most thrilling thing for us about doing what we're doing, it's what's going on in our heads, usually way before we're actually doing something on camera. because the problem solving, the conceptualizing of a of some sort of a situation is the real joy. I mean, our adrenaline levels are at their peak. So no, at least in my case, sometime in the early morning when I'm, you know, working out and thinking about what I've got to do that day. It's just thrilling.
Just the other day, we were setting up to do an episode on Western myths, which is a repeating concept because there's tons and tons of them. And we had this, we had one story, and then we had this other little story called shooting a gun out of somebody's hand. And we were thinking that this would be the kind of B little story we'd do in a couple of days and just knock it out. And so we started to write it down on the board. This is Monday. And after about an hour and a half, we realized, you know, we have to throw out the big story because this story is huge. And that's where we get really excited. Like, oh, my God, there's all this stuff to unpack in here because it's not just about this. It's about this and this and this. And then there's this other area. So we've got these. We had to actually throw out one whole set of experiments that we'd written because we'd written too many. You know, we came up with too many ways to start testing this thing.
Yeah, and as I can't tell the I'll spoil the story, but there's this thing that you know, when a bullet hits a gun, you know, the story is about it reacting to that impact and flying out of somebody's hand, and you start to go through that, and you realize that we've got equal and opposite reactions, things like this. We had dealt with this issue before, where, you know, in the movies somebody shoots somebody else, and that the person shot flies across the room and goes through a window or something like this. And, you know, it's unless the person holding the gun was also thrown back against the window, that's not really happening. And we showed that. And with this particular story, we're applying some of those same principles, but have come up with this really nutty way of actually measuring and precisely hitting the pistol.
We're still trying to figure out if it's legal.
Yeah,
we're still talking to people, and lots of people are not sure.
Watch the episode, though. It's this diabolical way that we came up with.
Don't give it away.
I'm not doing it. that we can actually show exactly what would happen in this case. Because when you go through it's like, you know, are you going to knock it out of, to measure these things, are you going to knock it out of somebody's hand with, you know, with some projectile or what? And so it's fun. It just all of a sudden it mushrooms. And we don't know that's what we're going to do until we get in it and start to visualize.
Sometimes we spot stories from a long way off where we got a penchant for something. I'd been wanting to swim in syrup for years.
Ooh.
Before we did that episode. Who wouldn't?
Me.
Show of hands. Show of hands. Yeah. Oh no.
Well, and I've got one that's we're going to be tackling soon, which was just a favorite kind of daydream of mine. I wondered what would happen. Was square? It's called Square Wheels Smooth Ride, and the idea being that surely at some point, if you went fast enough, if you had square wheels, it would smooth out. And so, you know, the problem is getting from zero to that speed.
Those first 40 miles per hour are really rough.
Yeah. So, you know, it's pretty hilarious. And there again, when we started to look into it, we found we haven't done this story yet, but there's some really actually practical, useful stuff that is coming out of this. You know, it seems silly, but it's like when you start to think about it, you know, there are practical applications for that type of a thing.
The thing about, actually, this is a great example too, is we have very different desires and goals going into each story. So Jamie comes up with this idea, Square Wheel Smooth Ride, and we work it into this kind of story. And Jamie, you know, halfway through a meeting, Jamie goes, you know, I don't care about any of this except this specific application of the square wheels. In fact, I could just eliminate this whole episode and just go right to this application. That's all I care about.
Yeah, in general, I'm still, after all this time, I'm like, get these darn cameras away from me. You guys are slowing me down. You know, it's shooting this show's pain in the butt. But, you know, it's still There's nobody else that's going to pay me to do what we do. So I guess I got to tolerate it.
And you got to recover your investment in that square wheel company somehow. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Moira Gunn. We're talking with Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman from the hit television program The Busters. Now, I don't know which one of your wives wrote this. If only one of you has a wife, that would be it. But how does your lovely wife put up with this?
We both have lovely wives.
Want to see the handwriting? No.
What's that?
Want to see the handwriting?
It's funny. We both come home and, like, getting ready for bed, we'll take our shirt off and we'll have a bruise or a cut or a scrape. And, you know, my wife will say, "What's that from?" I have no idea. You know, it happens so fast. We're moving so fast. We get bumps on the head. We get cuts and lacerations. Occasionally, after the trip to the hospital, my wife will be a little pissed off at me for not being more careful at the bandsaw. She'll remind me that it was invented for cutting meat.
In my case, I have to be careful if I call home in the middle of the day because, if I call my wife at any time other than, you know, when it's expected, it can mean,
what's wrong?
Yeah. It's like I have to talk to her first, telling her it's okay, which is, it's kind of unfortunate, really. But we at this point, we still have all of our digits. We've had quite a few scars, it's a weird place to be with that aspect. It's not relative to your question so much, but at this point, we sort of feel like our number's up because of the stuff that we've been doing. But at the same time, we're getting better at spotting risk and avoiding it. So where exactly are we? I don't know. We're still here and we're fine.
Exactly. I do want to say that while everybody was very excited that the two of you were coming, you know, there's a lot of fans out there for your cast or your crew, I guess we should call it, and your Mitherns and everything. Tell us about them. Tell us about how they play into the production.
Well, these are the other builders, Tori, Grant, and Carrie, and they pretty much run independently of us in their show. They're not they're by no means Mitherns or assistants or anything of the sort. They work at a separate shop, and we try to cross-pollinize wherever we can to make sure that we're advancing the same way. So far, the main challenge has been time, because we're cranking out shows as fast as we can.
After we'd filmed the first season of MythBusters in 2003, we did 13 episodes. We did 6 day weeks, 10 hours a day, for something like 30 weeks. We almost just died of exhaustion, and that was 13 episodes. And Discovery said, "That's great. Now we want 30." And we just, there's just not enough to go around. So they asked who we might think might be good hosts, good people. So I called up Tori Belleche, who I'd worked with up at Industrial Light and Magic during my stint up there. Carrie Byron had actually started out as an intern in Jamie's shop, and on her very first day, they put her in a leotard, and we scanned her butt for one of the very earliest episodes of MythBusters. That first season, we brought in Scotty Chapman, who's a terrific welder and a wonderful person who spent a season with us and then wanted to do more of her own personal stuff. So she moved on. She's still in contact. We brought her in for the rocket car revisit episode. And then when we replaced her, we brought in Grant Amharo, who Jamie and I had also both worked with at Industrial Light Magic.
So this is a two-part question, and I'll give you the first part first. Wasn't that brilliant of me? You both have children. You have two 10-year-old twins?
I have 10-year-old twins, yeah.
And how old are your kids?
I don't have children.
Oh, you don't have children. So yeah. I had the...
That he knows of.
That he knows of. You know, women never say that. We know. We were there, you know. And the reason I'm, like, being iffy, it's like I got some conflicting, you know, information about what's the bios. I have to ask it. But, okay, so you have two boys, 10 years old. Do you tell them what you do?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, okay, so I spend all day being on camera, and I get to travel around and speak to groups of people, and I get to enjoy this sort of marginal D-list fame that I've got. It's not like I go home every day and go, hey, everybody, check out what I did all day long. And in truth, the job, while glamorous on the outside, on a day-to-day, hour-by-hour level, is quite a blue-collar, exhausting job. So only occasionally do we go over in any great detail stuff that I've done, and only if it was really, really thrilling. We spent a couple of weeks ago, Jamie and I both got trained by a stuntman and had to fall off a building. And at the end of that day, I was so thrilled and so jazzed and actually so high on the adrenaline rush, I came home with the high-speed shot and showed my kids. But that's the exception rather than the rule.
So they're not, you're not filming at your home.
No.
So they don't see what you're doing.
No. They have come out on set. They've come out on set a bunch and watched us film various things, things smashing, things. I don't think they've been around for an explosion yet, but...
Yeah, they occasionally show up at the shop, and it's just they're just like Adam is. It's,
they wear glasses and everything.
Not, no. Do not stand on top of the ladders. Do not stand on top of the ladders, Adam.
They're always grabbing anything that can be a stick and beating each other with it.
They're normal. They're normal. Well, the second part of the question was, and this is for both of you, because we have a lot of teachers here really interested in how to teach curiosity and innovation and passion and all of those things you've been talking about. Can you look back in any of your schooling to say, does any of it help? Were there teachers or situations or anything that you think helped you today?
In my case, absolutely. Actually, I had four or five teachers throughout my 12 years of schooling. Besides my typing teacher, I think typing's the single greatest skill I got out of high school. But I had some terrific couple of creative writing teachers, a couple of art teachers, and a couple of science teachers, who got me, saw me, didn't let me get away with the kind of I was one of those students who could get B's without really working at it, and I had some teachers who pushed me a lot harder and who also took the time to talk to me about stuff that I was interested in. I remember my freshman year earth science teacher, Dan Frere, who just retired last year, actually. I used to stay after school and talk to him about questions I had about things that he was saying that had nothing to do with the lesson plan, but that were really fascinating to me. And he would just sit and say, I don't know, could be, let's look it up. I mean, it was so long ago, I'll tell you, he would smoke in the classroom. That's how long ago it was.
How about you, Jamie?
Well, I grew up on a farm, and there's something inherent to that that, you know, is sort of a can-do kind of a way of growing up. I was an ornery kid, and I think sooner or later my parents figured out just to, you know, leave them alone because there's no hope. And I would, what they also found out along with that anything that I took on, I'd gradually get control of and actually do quite well with. So it was sort of a balance that was hard won that they came to. And I don't recall any particular thing other than just that I kind of was just headlong adventurous. I'd go after anything just to see what happens, and it's sort of been the way that way ever since.
There's a lot of revealing questions here, and there's a lot of families, like my son and I, my brother and I. Actually, a lot of them are male, but I know a lot of them are female. You're just not writing down your names, so I don't have genders. I mean, we even have one in my family where my brother-in-law, Stu, his father was an MIT engineer, is an MIT engineer. So growing up, he kept gunpowder and hydrochloric acid in the basement. So now... Grandpa's, you know, he's retired, but after every one of your shows, they call each other up, you know, they feel like this. And there's, how many families here watch it together? Raise your hand. See a lot of that. So you get individual wow. fans coming up to you, but do you get a lot of, whether it's emails or people coming up to you, do you get a lot of families involved?
Tons. And it's the most, we didn't set out to make an educational show, honestly.
Well, you're in luck. No, I'm kidding.
And the The appreciation we get from science teachers about their Thursday morning science classes, they say, after our shows aired on Wednesday nights, the people who actually drive by our shop, they find us on Google Maps and come and take pictures of the building. And if we're outside, we'll take pictures and sign their autographs, and they're just like, we drove all the way from Tulsa. My son wanted to see the building. It's the idea that we're farting around with science and that this inspires kids is the most humbling aspect of doing what we do. We take it really seriously, but we definitely didn't set out to do it on purpose, and I think if we had, we would have failed.
Yeah, I think for both of us, the essence of what we're doing is just showing our curiosity. And I mean, we happen to be on camera. There's something to do with urban legends that's in the mix, but it's basically about curiosity. And so people of all ages hopefully have that. And you know, we don't pay in, I mean, we're that's just sort of is what it is, and people seem to gravitate to it. Kids, especially when they're looking at the world, I think see an adult that is basically playing, which that I became aware of that some time ago. That I look at it almost like, you know, puppies play, and they actually.
It's hard to think of you as a puppy, though, really.
Yeah. Well, and they actually learn by doing this. There's a reason for it, a very good reason, and that's kind of what we're doing is we're just playing, and you know, we sort of focus it in certain areas, and but you know, think about stuff like square wheels. I mean, it's just playing.
And who the hell needs to know that?
Yeah, I mean, we've done episodes on polishing turds, you know, and you definitely don't need to know how to do that.
But now you do.
Yeah, there was some serious stuff to be learned. This technique is actually an art form. It generally doesn't involve fecal matter, but you know, it's details. It shows that even in the most unlikely places that you can find just, you know, wonderful, fascinating stuff if you're curious about it.
There's a phenomenon which I love. Often I meet kids around town or in airports, and they'll see someone who they see on TV all the time, and they freeze like a deer in the headlights, and they can't speak when they. Oh my God! And I spoken for the last couple of years at the California Science Fair. I've given the keynote address. And I always hang out afterwards and sign autographs for the kids and stuff. And those kids, the kids who are interested in science will come up and they get the same thing. There's this pause and then they go, I was wondering when you did the episode where the mouse, is the elephant afraid of a mouse, why you used an albino mouse because they're not really natural in nature, and why you didn't use brown mice and black mice and other kinds? Like, the science brain bypasses the social filter that makes them nervous about meeting me, and I love watching that happen.
And could you answer that question? Because I saw a couple of nods out there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's a great question. Quite honestly, we were in South Africa.
I got two in here about the elephant and the mouse, so yeah. Go ahead, just answer it. Yeah.
We were in South Africa filming with great white sharks in False Bay in Simonstown, South Africa, and the weather kept us off of False Bay for 3 days, which was a production disaster. It cost us a fortune every day to be there. We needed to get a certain amount of footage in the can in order to produce this two-hour shark special, and we thought, we're just boned. What are we going to do? And we thought, you know, there's this nature preserve a few hours inland. Let's go there and do our Elephants Afraid of Mice. We thought we're producing 5 minutes of filler. This is just going to be kind of a joke. We did not expect to get an actual result. And when we watched the elephant stop, when the mice appeared out of the puppeted piece of dung we had made, when the mouse appeared and the elephant stopped and tiptoed around the mouse, I mean, it was one of the funniest and best things. Again, people ask if we're surprised by stuff that happens on the show, genuinely surprised. And yeah, it happens constantly, all the time. And that's one of the great examples of it. We simply didn't bring any other mice because we didn't think we were going to get something. We thought we were going to have a squashed mouse.
So you're just trying to be nice to the mice.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Yeah, and it happens every day. I mean, like Adam referred to earlier today, we're doing this thing about somebody breaking out of jail by saving up all his antacid tablets and, you know, lining the cell with plastic. And We did some small scale experiments, and you know, it doesn't. It at this point, we know, like, you know, well, it's just some antacid and everything, but we're looking at it, and it has safety glasses, huh? Yeah, let's back up a little bit. In fact, let's stand right here, you know, on this side instead of that. And we were right. You know, it's just.
You don't think the inmate had safety glasses, do you?
No.
Absolutely. Now, you're talking about, you know, learning more about the experiments themselves and framing them and framing the questions in the episodes. Is there something about how something has to be televised? You know, when you're trying to take video of it, it can't just work inside a box. I mean, you have to have things that are visual, right?
That's actually one of the lovely things about doing the show is the crew. It's not us by any stretch of the imagination. We have an amazing crew of about 25 people that produce this show. And the camera crew is very involved in how we set things up, where we set things up, and there's a lot of consultation back and forth. A terrific example of this is we did this full-hour episode called Seesaw Saga, where the little girl skydiver lands on one end of the seesaw and a little girl goes flying. And we were doing some small-scale tests, and Scott Sorensen, who's our second cameraman and high-speed camera operator, who's just a bloody genius with that thing, he and I spent about 2 hours doing all these little scale drops with this little dummy, and I was modifying him as we went to make his falls look more realistic. And then after I left, Scott did another, like, 3 hours of just drop tests, so he flies into frame. And so, I mean, we really do get artistic about it to tell the story. You know, we know that the more we give the editors, the more they're going to have to shade this story. And we'll even suggest things that are occurring to us, like you could throw this over here to demonstrate this, and they'll take that and run with it. And that goes all the way from, you know, the type of germination that we do to the discussion with the camera crew to the editors and the writers and the producers in Australia.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Moira Gunn. We're talking with Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman from the hit television program The Mythbusters. Well, I asked some of my eminent colleagues today at the university, you know, just what are your favorite episodes? And I asked my engineers and people over KQ today, what are your favorite episodes? And I'm going through these cards, all these questions. The exploding toilet's right up there. What? You know, they kind of sit there real quietly and go, the exploding toilet. That's really. Tell us about the exploding toilet.
We've done
and
a
why
couple.
Why you attribute it its popularity?
The hidden dangers at home.
Yeah.
We've actually done a couple of exploding toilets. We've done one where the oily rags or the like gasoline soaked rags get tossed in the toilet, and then the husband goes in for a constitutional and a smoke that goes bad. And then there's another one about the porta potty building up enough methane. I think that's the one they're referring to.
Well, actually, that's the one I was saying. You know, then you get the what would you say, the missile, the outhouse is missile,
yes,
kind of thing. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, but I think they do kind of confuse them all. It's just, well, they all refer to it. If it has anything to do with the toilet, it's very popular.
Maybe it's a poop. Maybe it's a poop thing. You know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just toilet humor. You know, it's popular.
Yeah, we're planning later on.
To
we
do a
wanna
series?
Do poop hitting the fan. As an idiomatic phrase.
Yeah, we got a whole string of them. And then there was one talking about the toilets. This is one that we'll probably never be able to do that. Yeah, you can probably tell it better than I. The one where there's a neighboring, the woman finds
we don't want to tell that story. Basically, a guy said, we can't tell that story. There's just
okay. No. You'll tell it to everybody in the lobby afterwards,
absolutely.
Right?
I'll tell it in the lobby once the camera's
on. You got all we have to do, which is normally what we do when
he's
get these things.
He's going to continue.
Well, no. You have to tell the story without using, you know, you can use
no,
a
I
word
know,
like
it's
fecal.
Just plain gross.
Fecal matter and, you know,
right.
Toilet.
Do the George Carlin and just kind of like go bleep or...
Well, so basically this husband found a very large deposit of fecal matter in the toilet and his wife denied that it was her. And he knew that it wasn't him and he emailed us for advice on how he should resolve this. And actually he wanted to know if such a large deposit could actually leave his neighbor's toilet and actually come into his toilet. as if on its own volition. And we thought, you should probably divorce her if she's denying that it's hers.
See, that wasn't that gross.
A girl has been in our bathroom,
I feel
number?
Dirtier for having told her.
I see. Well, you know, that actually leads to, there's been a couple of questions in here, that leads to, you know, how do we make a suggestion, or how do we get, you know, one of these things on the show? Do we have to, like, just write it down or tell you, or do we have to, like, come up with how to, you know, have a whole story?
Well, Discovery has forums online that you can submit myths to, but both Jamie and I are easily findable on the web. Our email addresses are out there. We still, amazingly, and maybe this will end when I say this, we still don't get too much that we can't read at all. And we get a tremendous amount of fantastic ideas from fans, and they get better as the years progress. There's this internet video that's going viral right now of a guy doing this really long water slide, flying a couple hundred feet through the air and landing in a kiddie pool. You know, we're going to be doing it within 4 months, I swear. And, you know, the number of people who tweeted that myth to me within 10 minutes of it hitting YouTube.
Saying, is it real or is it?
Yes. I'm also, don't try this on Twitter. So that's a great way. We've already done two stories that I've gotten through some of my tweeps.
I see. In terms of special effects work, we'll kind of go back there. It seems that there's a lot more jobs in special effects than there is in television for myth busting, just in general. How would people get into special effects work these days?
Well, actually, the kind of effects that we do, which is called, they're called practical effects, meaning that they don't involve digital technologies necessarily. I mean, that kind of work is greatly diminished. Most of the proper effects work is done digitally these days. Which is kind of a shame because it's the kind of things that, well, I don't know, there are a lot of well-known movies out there that shall remain unnamed that started out being done with real models and practically, and you've seen them go to entirely digital, and you know, the results sort of speak for themselves. There's a certain sort of I don't know.
A veracity.
There's depth. There's a spirit to real things that you often don't get in terms of from the digital stuff. And so, if you want to get into that line of work, odds are you're going to be sitting in front of a computer. And and not that that's bad by any sense. There's some wonderful stuff being done. But
that era of making spaceships, I mean, when I got to Industrial Light and Magic in 1999 and worked a little bit on Episode 1, worked extensively on Episode 2 and movies like AI and Space Cowboys, I really feel lucky because I felt like I slipped in under the wire before all that great spaceship building and
the model building went digital.
Yeah.
Used to be the model building, and you'd have it on tracks. And
a huge number of my friends are...
Now it's just replications, and you go to computer graphics.
Well, from my mind, it's just another tool. I mean, obviously, something like Jurassic Park is going to be better done with a digital type of effect, because to show a, you know, 50-foot-long Tyrannosaurus running around, you know, self-contained, is, you know, it's that would be a bit of a chore to make, and so you do that digitally. But there are other things that that practical models do better, and you know, when you, it just even down to a basic thing where if you've got somebody in front of a green screen having to act, I mean, yeah, you can do it, and you can be pretty convincing about it. But you know, is it going to be as good as, you know, as if you're actually working with real stuff? You know, there's a certain kind of, you know, there is a spirit and a soul to this creative endeavor, collaboration, that is going to be different from a bunch of people sitting in front of a TV set and versus a bunch of people out there actually doing some simulation of the real thing.
I have a practical and real answer to this question about special effects, because a lot of people think of it as a very creative enterprise where you do a lot of really creative stuff, and that's actually not true. 95% of it is absolute drudgery. Even in the model making department, you'll be making the same thing 50 times. And only when you pay those dues and work really hard and do all that crap work do you get often to do some fine tuning. But when you're looking at a portfolio, if you're interested in getting into special effects, if, whether a CG or not, the portfolio that you want to show isn't one that's full of really artistic, out there stuff. It's things like, can you build a perfect 57 Chevy in the computer? If you can do that, then they'll hire you because you've built something, they know what it should look like. And I've heard that from every special effects lead and person who's in charge of hiring that I've ever talked to. Jamie used to say, come in and show me a perfect featureless shiny black box and I'll hire you, because that is a very hard thing to build, actually.
Now, Adam, I have to take a I have to trust the audience member here, because I don't know about this. How have you progressed in your Maltese Falcon project?
Yeah, one of the things I get involved in my personal life is personal obsessions, and one of them has been making a replica of the Maltese Falcon from the film. And I've been doing it so long, I've given a series of talks about it over the last couple of years. And you'll be happy to know, earlier this year, I actually touched a real Maltese Falcon. I also took maybe 350 pictures of a real Maltese Falcon. And they showed me enough information that I have to start from scratch. So I'm going back to the beginning. At some point, when I have a free weekend, when my wife and I are just going to sit and try and make it through all the episodes of the last season of Lost in one weekend, I'll probably go to work on the next iteration of the Maltese Falcon. And then eventually, I'll make a master casting of that, and hopefully I'll end up with a lead one. I think I'm going to end up with like 25 when all is said and done.
What about Barack Obama's birth certificate?
I'll be happy to make one.
There you go. That would be good. What about the 9/11 truthers? I mean, that's a much bigger thing, and involves explosions. And
yeah, no, we've talked extensively about doing that on the show. The problem is one of the problem with that story specifically is it's such a large scale story. First of all, there is no conspiracy. The World Trade Center collapse is completely explainable by those planes hitting it and all of the physics involved there. There's no mystery, and no engineer I've ever talked to thinks there is a mystery. That being said, if we were going to tackle that on the show, when you start to try and scale material behavior, you get into a real hornet's nest, which means you have to work in as large a scale as possible. And when you're working with two of the tallest buildings in the world, almost no scale you could work in would be tall enough. That, coupled with the fact that the construction of the World Trade Center towers is actually quite unique in buildings, so finding a building that would match their construction of the outer shell with the inner support and the steel and concrete distribution would be devilishly difficult. It's not something I think we'll be tackling on the show.
When will the Commonwealth Club send the audience to witness a taping of your show, Van Happen?
Well, there's a good reason that we don't have an open set, and it's not
enough safety glasses.
Yeah, we have a saying, if at this point we ourselves have an agreement, if we're doing something and we think we need to run, we're going to run. And so
it's hard to get all these people to run.
Yeah. So
all right.
Yeah, commensurate with that, if you see us on the street and we're running, do your best to keep up.
Does that answer your question?
It does. And now from each of you, what's the first thing you remember blowing up on purpose? On purpose is the operative. Yeah.
The first thing before the show or during it?
Ever in your life.
Oh. I grew up in upstate New York, where you could take the train into New York, into Chinatown, and get those bottle rockets. And I discovered that if you poked a hole in the top of a bottle rocket, it wouldn't explode. It would shoot sparks out the top. So then I thought, well, what if I put a second bottle rocket on that and put the fuse in? And so it'll light it'll be like a two-stage rocket. And the first one went, and it worked. Unfortunately, the second one went, and came right back down and blew up at my feet.
Let that be a lesson to you. How about you, Jamie?
I think it involved a bullet and a vise and a hammer.
Oh, my God.
Almost as good as hydrochloric acid in gunpowder. Almost, yeah.
I was, you know, I would have been about 12 or something like that. And fortunately, there is a distinct difference between a bullet and a vice and a bullet and a gun. So I can say that for my, foolhardiness.
And hold up the hands, all digits appear. There we go.
Yep.
Very good, so.
There's a few dozen. I joke that I've got about 45 stitches in this hand, and that's because I'm always holding the tool in this hand.
Yeah, I don't. Have you ever had a broken bone?
I've only broken one bone in my body, and it's my 7th vertebrae. I broke my neck in a diving accident on my 17th birthday.
There you go. Unbelievable. Well, unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there's only one last question. So to each of you, you're clearly leading lives of passion. I mean, it's really great. You get up in the morning, you love talking about this, you love doing it. Can you say, each of you, something about why that's so important and how you find that?
That's funny. It's something that both Jamie and I came to, I think, in our lives through totally different paths. For me, my father was a painter and a filmmaker, someone who left every job he hated in the middle of it and painted for 3 or 4 hours a day every day of my childhood. And so I grew up with someone deeply committed to doing what they wanted to do and being really excellent at it, exploring their excellence at it. He and my mom also deeply encouraged the things that I was interested in. They gave me, I still can't believe this, unfettered access to the charge account at the hardware store from the age of 12 on. And when I moved into New York City, he gave me access to his charge account at the art store. And both of those experiences of me having autonomy in a store full of materials was incredibly important in the makeup of me learning to learning what I wanted to learn, you know, figuring out what my ambition was. And I always wanted to emulate that I saw in my father and my mother, that doing something you were happy at.
Jamie.
Well, I think anybody that watches this show sort of would understand that we both feel like we have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to job satisfaction. And we really do feel that way. I think in my case, it's been a result of realizing a couple of things. First is that, you know, you have to follow your heart. You have to follow your passion and what your, you know, your what makes you happy challenges you and excites you, those kinds of things. But you also have to do it in a methodical and practical way if you're going to be able to realize those things to their fullest degree. Because sooner or later, if you're, you know, the starving artist syndrome, it might work for some people, but I think in our case, like when you look at what we do with what we've done before this show and what we're doing now, we're making a living, we're doing things that we're interested in. If we were totally uncompromising about either of those things, then we wouldn't be near as satisfied as we are.
Well, please join me, my audience, everyone on the internet, everyone everywhere. Thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you.
Heineman,
thank you.
And Adam Savage.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our audience here tonight at the Commonwealth Club, enjoying the Mythbusters here, and everyone on the radio, on the internet, on television, everyone, everywhere. I'm Moira Gunn, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. The exploding gavel. It could work.